Welcome to a subscriber-only Q&A on Conversations with Coleman. I'm your host, Coleman Hughes. So let's get into these questions, which are all from supporters of the podcast. All right. Question one. How can we nurture a return to dialogue and conversation about sensitive and complex problems, as opposed to falling back on tribal alliances? Okay, so this is a question I think I get in some way every time I do one of these Q&As, and it really is the million-dollar question. How do we have conversations on emotionally charged topics, both in private and in public? So I think the first way we address this is to model this behavior in your own life. Like, have conversations about hard topics with your friends and family members, and be a good listener and try to phrase your points in the most useful way possible and try to communicate your good intentions. And so modeling it in your own life is step number one. And then step number two is to use whatever platform you have to amplify examples of good conversations. And I think that's part of what many of you are trying to do by supporting someone like me, is that presumably you think I'm a good example of someone having real conversations rather than BS cable news style faux conversations. And so you support me and you promote me, and I appreciate that. But we use whatever platform you have to reward what is good out there. So that's step one and two, I think. Model it in your own life and then do whatever you can to promote the people that are doing it well. And then the third part of this equation is, I think, the most difficult and the area where I could talk all day, but it will seem to do nothing to actually move the ball forward, which is to disincentivize and stop amplifying bad conversations. This is really the hard part, because we want to call out cheap arguments and shouting matches where neither side is listening. And we want to criticize that, but in criticizing it, we are often actually amplifying and incentivizing more of it, right? Like, just by sharing the link of the conversation that you hated, the back and forth on cable news that you think is BS, just by sharing that link and complaining about how cheap the conversation is, you are incentivizing more of those kinds of conversations. Because, you know, the bottom line of media companies does not care whether you're hate sharing or love sharing. That is neutral as regards the profit motive. So, you know, we demand, this is ultimately a demand side problem. It's like, at the end of the day, it is us who demand these cheap fights and shouting matches with where we direct our attention. You know, it's very similar to the rubbernecking phenomenon when you're driving. You're on the highway and suddenly everything slows down and you're pissed off. You wonder why there is traffic. And then eventually you see a horrible accident and you turn and you look and you realize the source of the traffic was the accident. And the moment you've passed the accident, now you're going 70 miles an hour again. And, you know, by the very fact that you saw the accident, you in fact are the problem, right? The source of the traffic was just the sum of people that turned their head for 2 seconds to look at the accident and slowed down imperceptibly. And so the whole time you were mad at a problem that you are as much a part of as anyone else. And social media has that kind of character. It's like, I can get mad at the bullshit, bad faith argumentation that happens all the time. But in complaining about it and in sharing examples of it, even in condemning it, I am a source of the clicks that form the motive for people to have more and more of those kinds of conversations. And it's very difficult to actually bootstrap your way out of that paradox with pure willpower. So it's easy for me to just say, stop sharing, you know, bad conversations. But, you know, it's far more difficult to actually do that. And if we find a solution to this problem, I don't think it's going to be from just like everyone turning up the dial on their willpower overnight somehow. It's going to be, you know, people like Tristan Harris, who I've had on this podcast, and others figuring out ways to structure social media so as to promote less of the bullshit conversations and more of the real ones. You know, I'm tempted to talk a little bit about the Jon Stewart, Andrew Sullivan conversation, for instance, as an example of a really ineffectual conversation where, you know, Andrew was more or less ambushed by Jon Stewart and some guests, and really nobody learned almost anything. Like, nobody came out of hearing that conversation more enlightened. And this is obviously from the same Jon Stewart that famously called out the Crossfire show back in the day for being, you know, for holding false conversations, or for holding conversations where very few people's minds were ever persuaded. Bad faith conversations. And he has now begun to do the same thing. And again, in calling this out, no doubt I'm sending some of you to go watch the Jon Stewart, Andrew Sullivan clash and add to the numbers that episode gets, which directly leads people to have more of those kinds of conversations. So we need to find structural solutions to this, ways to change the social media algorithm so as to disincentivize the sort of factional vitriol and to incentivize real conversations. Okay, next question. If you could bring back one dead philosopher, thinker, or activist for a podcast episode, who would you choose? Okay, so that's a tough one. I think I would probably choose Martin Luther King. You know, what would Martin Luther King have said about wokeness or about the explosion of wealth at the very top end of the income distribution, or the stagnation of wages for the working class, or the rise of Trump, or, you know, shipping manufacturing jobs overseas and the restructuring of the economy away from manual labor? What would he have said about the reality of racial disparities and crime and the phenomenon of mass incarceration, which pretty much incurred almost entirely after his death? What would he have said about affirmative action, not as an interim measure, but as a permanent way of doing business? These are all things I would love to ask him if he were alive. And so I guess he would be my top choice. Moreover, I think there's this ongoing battle for the legacy of Dr. King. You'll notice every Martin Luther King Day, there's a spate of articles in all kinds of outlets that essentially say the same thing. What they say is Dr. King was really a radical. He was a radical who would have more or less agreed with the tenets of wokeness, and the conservatives have whitewashed his legacy in an attempt to claim his mantle, right? They've selectively quoted him to make him seem way more moderate than he actually was. And the implication is if he were alive today, he'd be supporting Black Lives Matter. He'd be supporting the sort of racial justice policies of the far left in general. And so, you know, you can just look up Dr. King was a radical. This article has been written probably literally 50 times. And I've read most of them. Basically, what they do is they quote Martin Luther King on topics that really have nothing to do with race. They quote him on the Vietnam War, which he was very much against, before it was popular to be against the war. So he was against the war and in fact was a pacifist. He was sort of a pacifist full stop, which is a radical position. He was almost against war as such, or he seemed to be, the way he talked about it. So they'll quote him on the Vietnam War having been a, quote, radical. They will quote him on issues like universal health care, a full employment policy, various other Bernie Sanders-like democratic socialist policies. And then they will jump from those facts about what he believed to saying, see, he was really a radical, just like us. And, you know, sometimes they will take one quote from Letter from Birmingham Jail about how he was disappointed more in the white moderate than in the white racists, in the inaction of the white moderate rather than the racist action of the white racists. I mean, the truth about Dr. King's legacy is fairly straightforward. You know, I've read every page of like a 400-page book of his speeches and essays. And when it comes to the meaning of racial identity, whether your race is a significant part of your identity, whether your being one race and my being another means that there's some kind of gap between us, epistemologically or spiritually or emotionally. I mean, he was just utterly clear on this point and totally consistent and totally incompatible with modern day social justice beliefs, intersectionality, critical race theory. There is just, I mean, at one point I tweeted on Martin Luther King Day a few years ago, like 12 or 13 Dr. King quotes from his speeches and essays, no single one of which you could really hear coming out of the mouths of a Black Lives Matter spokesperson, for instance, or a critical race theory professor. Any one of them would have been too quote-unquote colorblind to actually escape the mouth of the woke, essentially. So to say that he was radical on unrelated issues like universal health care and a full employment policy and raising the minimum wage and opposing the Vietnam War before that was popular, none of that proves that he was at all aligned with race consciousness or with woke attitudes towards the meaning of race in general. He was utterly clear on that point, and there's been a very dishonest rewriting of history by those folks. In fact, they are the ones whitewashing his legacy because, you know, if you actually read him, it's so clear that he was against the weaponization of racial identity in all directions. And that is a huge embarrassment to the intersectional left. It's a huge embarrassment to the intersectional left because they couldn't honestly claim to be continuing the tradition of Martin Luther King vis-a-vis the issue of race and racial identity. They cannot claim that honestly, so they can only claim it dishonestly and via this hand-waving where they make you look at other issues and sort of impute the vibe of those radical policies onto race, where Dr. King certainly didn't. So that's another thing I would want to talk to him about if I could talk to him today. Okay, next question. You've often spoken about your belief that narrowing racial disparities is not the same as improving society. Is there any extent to which you think narrowing racial disparities is in and of itself useful? Why and how big of a priority, if so? Okay, this is a great question. And I'm going to have an extended discussion of this exact question in my forthcoming book, which all signs point to being finished this year. So I would argue that equal outcomes between races are not inherently good. They are not good in and of themselves. And I would also argue that if you disagree with that claim, you actually haven't thought about it long enough or in the right way. I will use a cliche example, but I think it's cliche for a reason. Nobody cares that the NBA is 3/4 black in its racial makeup. Nobody cares. Black people don't care. White people don't care. Asians don't care. Hispanics don't care. Jews don't care. Nobody is offended by that massive disparity. Here are some other disparities that I can guarantee almost no one in the world is offended by. Chinese Americans make far more money every year than Thai Americans. Ghanaian Americans make far more money every year than Ethiopian Americans. Russian Americans make far more money every year than French Americans, although that might not be true this year. I could do an hour-long podcast simply reciting facts of this kind, disparities of this kind that nobody cares about and that we're right not to care about. So that is all to say that equal outcomes aren't even really the goal sought by people who claim to care about it in general, right? So what gives here? What is it that people are being dishonest or people just haven't thought through the issue enough? Well, it's partly the second thing, but it's also that when people claim to care about equal outcomes, without realizing it, what they really care about is whether the process by which those outcomes were reached is a fair process. So let me tell you the reason why people don't care that the NBA is 3/4 black, whereas black people only represent 12, 13% of the population. The reason people don't care about that disparity is because everyone knows that the process of getting to the NBA is as pure a meritocracy as has ever existed in almost any human domain. It's like as close to meritocracy as human systems could reasonably get. They know that the very best basketball players reliably end up in the NBA, regardless of their skin color. And so because we know the process is fair, we actually don't care what the outcome is. When people start claiming to care about the equality of the outcome, what's actually behind that concern, what's motivating it, unacknowledged, is a sense that the system might be unfair, that the system might be taking factors into account, such as race, which are arbitrary and unfairly penalizing certain individuals and not others as a result of traits that they cannot control. People worry that the prison system, for instance, is not fair. And there's no doubt it's nowhere near as fair as the NBA. I don't think even the staunchest defenders of the criminal justice system would allege that. I mean, for one thing, to be rich is to experience an entirely different criminal justice system than to be poor. But when people claim to worry about results, what they're actually motivated by, I would argue, is a concern that the process is not fair. It is the process we ultimately care about. And if we could be guaranteed that the process was fair, if it were transparently obvious that the process is fair, such as it is in most sports, suddenly we just stop caring about whether the results are equal, right? Nobody cares if, you know, 5 spelling bee winners in a row are Indian. Nobody cares because it's so clearly a pure competition, a competition devoid of any bias. So the moment we can be assured that the process is fair, we stop caring about the results. And that's I think it's a deep insight into human psychology and what we actually care about deep down versus what we claim to care about. So one thing we really care about is fairness, which gets mistranslated into caring about equal outcomes when it's really about the process. But another thing we care about is progress. We want to feel like we are doing better than our parents were, that we have more opportunity, more wealth, that it is easier to be healthy, that we are living in safer times. In many ways, the project of civilization is to safeguard the institutions that allow for reliable progress. So we care about fairness on the one hand, and we care about progress on the other. So how does this fit in to the goal of closing the gaps, which is obviously all the rage and is behind almost every article you've ever read that mentions a black-white outcome gap, whether that is in health or wealth or incarceration. The implication behind that way of framing the issue is that to close the gaps would be to make the kind of progress we should care about. But again, I would argue, first of all, we do not care about gaps in themselves, and we are right to not care about gaps in themselves when you think through the issue fully, right? What we should care about are the metrics that have something to do with actually increasing flourishing for humans. And one thing that increases flourishing is when processes are fair and when we know they're fair. And another thing that increases human flourishing is when we are progressing on all of the metrics that we care about, you know, life expectancy and income and wealth and all the rest. So this obsession with closing gaps is much more superficial than it appears. For instance, you could close all of these gaps simply by making white people worse off. As a thought experiment, just consider if we just took wealth away from white people and incarcerated more and more white people until the metrics looked the same between blacks and whites. At the same time, we would have created a more equal and worse world. The variables of equality and human flourishing are orthogonal to one another, in my view. They are just two separate goals. To pursue one at some point is to go against the other, right? Because they're just not the same thing. And too much of our discourse assumes that they are. So my preferred way of thinking about progress is this way. When I think of whether my family has made progress, common sense would say I compare my life to my dad's and my mom's, and ultimately I compare my life to my grandparents, and I just notice how many more opportunities I had than he had, how much easier certain things were for me than for him as a result of the engine of technological progress, the expansion of full citizenship rights to Black Americans, and so forth. The decline of wars in general, which is a strange thing to say as Mariupol is getting bombed, but you know, the general decline of wars as testified in books like Steven Pinker's. So why is it that when we think about groups, we don't use the same paradigm? Why is it that you will never see an article that, rather than comparing average Black statistics today to average white stats today, instead ask the question, how are Black people doing today as compared with how they were doing 20, 30 years ago? Has life expectancy been going up? Has wealth been going up? And so forth. Very rarely do you see the question of progress framed that way, even though that's really the more intuitive way to frame the question. If you want a lot more on that, you should look at my essay, The Case for Black Optimism, which I wrote many years ago for Quillette. I wrote like a 3,000-word essay going into detail about why I think benchmarking progress against the same group in the past makes more sense than benchmarking progress against the goal of closing gaps in the present. So you can see more about that if you're interested. And then the last thing I would say about this is that I can carve out examples where diversity does matter. Like whether there's actual equal representation, I'm not sure that really ever matters, because who is really bean counting in this way? But in general, there are situations where racial diversity does matter. And I think I've talked about this in a Q&A before. It matters where it is an essential component of doing an important job. It's like where the job of an important institution can't be done except by a racially diverse group of people. Well, then I can see the case for diversity mattering. So for example, policing, if you're going to police a mixed race neighborhood or a Black neighborhood, and all the cops are white, that seems like a recipe for disaster, because, you know, it sets up a situation where a community feels like they are being policed by people that have no connection to them. And the accusations of racism are just, you know, almost guaranteed to make it actually harder to police and protect that community. So that would be an exception I can think of. There may be others. There almost certainly are some others. But I think they're rarer. They're far more rare than the areas where we are pretending that diversity is crucial or that racial equality of outcome is crucial when it's in fact not. Okay, next question. What do you think about the argument, "I'm not a racist, my best friends are black"? I consider it a valid argument, but I get laughed at when I discuss it with my friends. Okay, good question. To me, this is clearly a valid argument if you're operating on my definition of a best friend and my definition of a racist. So like my definition of a racist is someone who really dislikes, for instance, black people because they're black. Like being black is enough for you to be on his bad side. How could a person like that actually have best friends who are black? And again, my definition of a best friend is someone, it's like practically family, right? It's someone who you have chosen to intertwine your life with in a deep way. So insofar as you are really operating on those definitions, it is a totally sound argument. The problem is people have actually pretty loose definitions of both of those words. People have an incredibly loose definition of racism that would include people who, for instance, don't like affirmative action or don't agree with everything Black Lives Matter has put forth. People who opposed defund the police were called racist. Anyone who voted for Donald Trump was called racist. So when you have grouped so many people in this category based on political beliefs, well then I guess having a black friend doesn't prevent you from being a racist, but that's just an absurd definition. That's an absurd expansion of a term that should be reserved for the actual racists, in my opinion. And, you know, I guess as a secondary point, people do often speak loosely about best friends. You know, there's a kind of person that describes everyone as their best friend. And that has a way of cheapening that term too. So if you're operating on rigorous definitions of these words, then yeah, it is a valid argument. And people shouldn't laugh at it. But unfortunately, those words have been so degraded by overuse that on expansive definitions, the argument no longer runs through. Okay, next question. I recently listened to the episode, "Is Matt Taibbi a Right Winger?" And I was especially struck by the part of the conversation regarding censorship, either by the government or big tech. I was left wondering if you thought the speech surrounding the election and the quote, "big lie" should have been censored. Are there any instances where dangerous misinformation should be censored? And take the example of COVID. Okay, so here's what I would say about censorship. The truth is, the powers that be are horrible at telling the difference between misinformation and the truth. I'll repeat that. The powers that be, both in the government and at big tech companies, are horrible at telling the difference between misinformation and the truth. That is a fundamental observation that, you know, folks like Matt Taibbi and many others have pointed out. That is just true. And it's proved over and over and over again. They're just not that good at fact-checking, right? Even the fact-checkers are not always great, but the powers that be in government and at big tech companies that think they can censor what's false, they have very little idea what's false. It's hard to figure out what's true in the world. It's not easy. And what's more, the people with their hand on the levers, they're not fact checkers. Their jobs, their competence is not to figure out what's true. They're not good at it. What are they good at? The people who run big tech companies are good at running big tech companies, right? Government bureaucrats are good at being government bureaucrats. neither of those two job descriptions entail being great at telling truth from falsehood. And so we shouldn't be surprised that these people keep getting it wrong over and over again. They're going to keep getting it wrong. We have to establish a norm that they don't censor things, in my view. And so I could give any number of examples here, but I mean, the most recent one is the Hunter Biden laptop story, right? The idea that Hunter Biden left his laptop at a repair shop in Delaware, and it was eventually made its way into the hands of Rudy Giuliani and others who found emails on it, which spoke to Hunter Biden's intent to cut deals with Ukrainian and Chinese companies and cut his father in on some of these deals, where he was essentially influence peddling. He was selling his influence to these companies as the son of Joe Biden. Presumably, these companies felt being close to power was worth what they were paying Hunter Biden to do nothing, essentially. So that was censored as misinformation. And a bunch of CIA officials came out saying it had all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation. And the New York Post, which initially broke that story, was locked out of its Twitter account for, I think, 2 weeks in the weeks before the 2020 election. The story has been totally vindicated. It was totally true. Pretty much all of it was true. It was well-sourced. And what's worse, there was no reason to believe it was untrue at the time. It wasn't a good faith error. It wasn't like it had Russian fingerprints all over it. No one could confirm the story. It was just good reporting on a true story that has now been acknowledged by everyone from the New York Times to the Washington Post to have been completely true. And it was just censored, right? I mean, that's just one example. Lab leak is another example, right? We don't know if this is true yet. I still suspect that it probably is more likely to be true than the alternative hypothesis. But it was censored as misinformation and dangerous conspiracy for a long time before people finally realized there's actually as much or more evidence that it's true as there is of the wet market hypothesis for the origin of COVID. And, you know, the powers that be got that one wrong. Whether myocarditis was a side effect worth talking about with the mRNA vaccines, right? Whether the vaccine stopped you from contracting COVID, right? Initially, that was called misinformation for a while. And then it turned out, well, yeah, you can still get it if you're vaccinated. It turned out that the real benefit of it was preventing serious illness and death. Whether cloth masks work was called, if you said cloth masks don't work, that was misinformation at one point. If you remember back in the very beginning of the pandemic, you had the New York Times and Vox and everyone saying that masks actually don't work at all. Masks don't work. And then a month later, it was like, okay, masks work. So, you know, if you had said masks work, that was misinformation at that time. We now know through the New York Times and other places that the CDC has admitted to hiding data about the efficacy of booster shots in young people because they thought it would play into the hand of the anti-vaxxers, which is to say the data about whether the booster shot was worth it for young people did not totally support or did not obviously support the claim that it was worth it for young people. And so the CDC hid that data and only showed the data for older folks, where it more supported the pro-vax point of view. So, I mean, there's a million and one examples that could be used here, but the point is the censors have very little idea what is true. They are horrible at telling the truth from falsehoods, and we should stop being surprised when they get it wrong and when misinformation gets weaponized to serve the political agenda of one party or the other. And for big tech companies, that's almost always serving the interests of Democrats, broadly speaking, because big tech companies lean left. So, you know, this is a feature, not a bug. The censors keep getting it wrong, and they should stay out of the fact-checking business because they're no good at it, and they won't be. They have no incentive to get good at it. They never will get good at it, right? Their improvement is not around the corner. It's never coming. Okay, last question. I'm an executive in the software industry, and I was curious what you think about inclusive hiring directives. My company is pushing me to use programs like Women in Technology and Minorities in Technology as hiring platforms. My concern is that if we're truly concerned about inclusion, should we really be exclusive and only hire based on gender and race? Also, why don't I see this kind of initiative in fields dominated by women, like nursing or education? I don't see programs making sure there are equal numbers of men represented in these fields. Is it entirely possible that women and minorities just either aren't interested in this type of work to the same degree, or grow up in environments where this type of field isn't considered? Okay, so there are a couple different lanes to this question, and they strike against various different taboos. The first is the fact that men and women are different at the average, right? This, you know, almost most people in the world know this to be true from personal experience and from being parents and from being humans long enough, but men and women at the average do not want precisely the same things. And that doesn't mean there aren't many women that want to be CEOs. There are. But there are not the same amount of men and women that want to be CEOs and want to work 18 hours a day and ignore their kids. There are simply more men that want to do that. You can argue that that's all a matter of how we raise men and women differently, but I just don't think that's the case. I think at bottom, there are biological differences between men and women that have psychological consequences, so that there are not the same amount of men and women that want to be nurses, for instance. And we should be okay with that. What we should want to maximize is that men and women feel free to pursue in an unencumbered way whatever suits them, right? Like the problem with, you know, the old equilibrium of just, you know, every woman has to be a housewife kind of an attitude and, you know, get back in the kitchen where you belong and that whole history of misogyny. The problem with that isn't that it's wrong to want to be a homemaker. The problem was that it's wrong to be forced or pressured to be a homemaker. The pressure and the force applied and the various glass ceilings, those were the problems. So we want to be getting rid of barriers, but we really should not feel a burden to get anything like equality of outcome in technology any more than we should feel that burden in a place like nursing. So that's men and women. When we think about race, the whole conversation about racially equal outcomes just ignores the fact of cultural differences between groups. What do we mean by something like cultural diversity? Well, we mean that people come from different cultures and therefore have different values, beliefs, desires. Like, what are you celebrating when you celebrate cultural diversity? You're celebrating the fact that people are different. People are raised different. They're raised to believe different things. They're raised to want different things. And you're celebrating those differences rather than stoking fear around them. That's the whole point of cultural diversity. Words like multicultural mean nothing if cultures aren't actually different. What's more, culture matters. Culture really matters. Culture is more than just the food you ate for dinner as a kid. It runs deeper than that. And most left-wing intellectuals throughout the past 100 years would agree with the point that culture matters the moment you're talking about nature versus nurture, right? Intellectuals on the left have tended to emphasize the nurture half of that equation, the culture versus genetics. aspect of that equation. So in the abstract, almost anyone I talk to would agree with me that cultures differ from one another and that culture matters. But when you add those two up and say that cultural differences matter, somehow it becomes taboo and people start becoming enormously dishonest or just won't run with you on that, right? So could cultural differences matter enough to cause disparities all by themselves? The answer to that question is certainly yes. And yet that hypothesis is somehow regarded as racist or disproven. And that infects this whole conversation, right? That we shouldn't expect in a world where cultures differ from one another, people are raised to value and believe and want different things. In that world, we should not expect every culture to produce the same number of everything. That's an insane expectation. So we have to focus on making processes more fair without the measure of our success being equal outcomes. So I will leave it there for now. This has been a good Q&A. I hope you all enjoy this, and thank you so much for your continued support.